Good evening and welcome to our two-part series on mindfulness. We're very lucky tonight to have two people from McLean Hospital who are experts on mindfulness, and so I will turn over the evening to them. And if you have questions during the evening, please email neabpd@aol.com and we'll take a few minutes for questions. Welcome Dr. Aguirre and Dr. Galen.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Perry, and welcome to all our listeners tonight. Just a little bit about how each of us got to mindfulness. I'll introduce myself, then Dr. Galen will, and then we'll divide the talk up into various sections. So I started off at McLean 12 years ago, very interested in borderline personality disorder, but not that interested at all in DBT until I discovered that it was a much more effective treatment than the treatment that I was doing. I was always very intrigued by the idea of mindfulness, but didn't know much about it. And I had the opportunity 5 years ago to go on the first of three silent mindfulness retreats with Dr. Marsha Linehan in Phoenix, in Tucson. And it was while there that I discovered the profound utility of mindfulness. So I'd never been felt I needed it or anything like that, but I found that it was a way to help me reduce suffering, regulate my emotions, control my experience on a day-to-day way. And I could see from that point what the utility would be in borderline personality disorder. My colleague, who will introduce herself in a second, Dr. Galen and I, in seeing the utility of borderline personality disorder, then decided to write a book together, and we're hoping that the book comes out in the spring of 2012, Mindfulness for Borderline Personality Disorder. So I have been the medical director of the 3 East DBT program for borderline personality disorder for since inception about close on 5 years ago, and remain so today. And with that, I'll pass you to Dr. Galen.
Hi, I'm Dr. Jillian Galen. I'm a clinical psychologist. I've been working at 3 East with Blaze for the past 4 years. I'd worked at McLean and then left to go to grad school and came back to do my postdoc with him at 3 East. And I actually brought a lot of mindfulness back with me. During graduate school, I had really found mindfulness through a yoga practice and had become a yoga instructor and had been pretty fascinated about my own experience of mindfulness and yoga and sort of the transformations that happened sort of in my own mind and just as it sort of, the more I practice, the more changes I notice sort of off of the yoga mat in terms of just emotion regulation and sort of really looking at the world, I think, in a different way, and became very interested in yoga and mindfulness in just general mental health treatment and did some research on that, but had always been working sort of in DBT and found that it was a pretty natural fit for me given that the core skill was mindfulness. So it was pretty much a perfect fit for me. I had done some silent retreats before I had come back to 3 East and then also got to go on a retreat with Blaze and Dr. Marsha Linehan. So I feel very strongly about the utility of mindfulness, I think, in everyone's lives, and particularly in the lives of people with borderline personality disorders and I think all of the loved ones, you know, friends and also treatment providers. So that's a little bit about how I came to mindfulness, and I'm going to pass it back to Blaze, who's going to talk a little bit about sort of the basics of mindfulness and where it came from and how it works.
So although mindfulness is well known within the treatment of borderline personality disorder and within dialectical behavioral therapy, arguably the first clinician to bring it to contemporary clinical practice in the United States was Dr. Jon Kabat-Zinn, and he had a classic definition, one that I think has tremendous utility today, and said that mindfulness is paying attention in a particular way, which is on purpose, so that you're doing it on purpose in the present moment and non-judgmentally. Others have defined mindfulness as simply just being present. Many of our kids will say that what they're doing is staying in the moment or becoming aware of what is going on around you or within you or being in the here and now. And so if you think about it, for all of our listeners out there, being mindful, and if they were to practice their own mindfulness right now, what you would do is, if you've got the TV on, if you've got the kettle boiling, if you've got a Yankees game on in the background, if you're playing with your animals, it would be to stop doing all of that and just listen, simply listen. And that would be mindful. So you would bring your attention and your awareness to the phone call, to the voice, without distraction. And then if you did get distracted by the dog barking, by the TV being put on, by someone calling you, is to notice the distraction and then bring your mind back to the present, bring it back to the call. And this act of noticing that you've been distracted and the act of noticing and coming back to the call is mindfulness. And so the idea of noticing, hey, my mind has been distracted, I've become less aware of what I'm doing, and I'm paying attention back to this moment. I'm noticing judgments as they arise. That is the act of mindfulness. And so the idea is that almost anything, people say, well, what are good mindfulness practices to us? And what we say is literally that anything that you can do mindlessly, you can do mindfully. You can pick up a fork and use it mindfully or mindlessly. You can brush your teeth mindfully or mindlessly. Lots of things that we do, most of the things in life mindlessly, and we can do those mindfully by saying, I am going to pay attention to just this thing. You can find mindfulness and meditation in most of the world's religions. You can find yogic meditation in the Hindu tradition, Kabbalah meditation in Judaism, contemplative prayer in Christianity, and Sufi meditation in Islam. And for the purpose of the way that mindfulness is used in dialectical behavioral therapy, we use the Zen practices of Buddhism because they hold very specific instructions to do with the experience of having borderline personality disorder. But nevertheless, all of these practices, all of these religions and all of these traditions have the same ultimate goal and focus, and that is pay attention to this moment, whether it's God, Allah, love, whatever it is. And so if you take away the religious aspect of it and make it non-religious, then you can take the spirituality out of it. And for some people, having the spiritual connection is really important. For other people, having the spiritual connection is too tied into mysticism and they don't like it. So all we say is, pay attention. Now, the idea is that the more we practice mindfulness, like any other skill, the better we get at it. The more we practice Spanish, the better we get at Spanish. The more we practice mathematics, the better we get at it. The more we practice yoga, tennis, golf, whatever it is, the more you practice mindfulness, the better you're going to get at it. And by better, I simply mean that it's going to be easier to do. The other thing is that if you practice doing something very ineffectively, then the better you get at it, at doing it ineffectively, so if someone plays tennis or golf or whatever they do, and they don't do it correctly, but they do it over and over again, then they get good at doing that thing incorrectly. And so the idea of practicing mindfulness is to really take on a certain way of doing it on purpose and doing it in a way that's effective for you. Now, for a lot of people, they kind of imagine someone lying on a yoga mat in relaxed pose and totally at peace with the world. Now, it may be a function of mindfulness that they become peaceful, but the purpose of mindfulness is not to get relaxed. If you get relaxed, that's a wonderful side effect, you could say, or side benefit of mindfulness, but it's not the purpose. The other thing is that when you, as with anything else, if you've been a foreign language speaker and you've spoken the language French for many years and then you stop speaking it, you begin to lose that skill. And it's the same with mindfulness. When you start practicing it, you get better at it, more effective at it, and then when you stop practicing it, you get less skilled at it. And I met a mom today who told me that she had done mindfulness for 5 years and that once she had kids, she stopped doing it and wishes she could go back to it and had lost a lot of the benefit that she'd had from stopping her practice. So what happens is that most of the behaviors that we do habitually and mindlessly without paying attention to them. So one of the things, ways of getting around this problem is to adopt what the Buddhists call a beginner's mind. If you remember the very first time you saw something, as a child or even as an adult, something brand new, the awe with which you saw it, the awe with which you saw the pyramids or the Mississippi or the Grand Canyon, and it was like, that was the first time, it was so impressive. And then if you see it habitually, then, you know, it begins to, oh, yeah, ho-hum, I've seen that before, and it's not that exciting. But that, we in mindfulness, we ask people to bring that beginner's mind, bring that awe, bring that newness to every moment. Find that which is new in that moment, and that can, you know, keep it without becoming habitual, without getting stuck, without saying, yes, I know that what these moments are. So it is important to have an attitude of openness, eagerness, and lack of preconceptions, lack of assumptions, and lack of certainty, you know, when studying any subject. It's not that you know how to speak Spanish or French or how to cook or whatever it is, you know, that even as when you're very advanced, when you're an advanced cook or when you're an advanced language speaker or whatever it is, the same thing, when you're advanced at mindfulness, is to begin as if you did not know it. And that brings the newness to it. That brings the openness to learn new things. So for borderline personality disorder, you can imagine, because what we see with a lot of people who suffer from borderline personality disorder is that their mind is all over the place. And all too often, the mind is stuck in a past that's full of hurt, full of suffering, full of injury, full of slights, full of anger from other people, full of anger towards other people, or it's stuck in a future that is suffering, a future that is full of failure, a future of being unloved, a future of not knowing what's going to happen, not knowing if they'll be with someone, wondering whether people are going to hurt them and attack them. And so what we know, and this is also comes from Zen practice, is that attachment and clinging are at the root of most of our suffering. So that it's when we hold on to things that have happened, hold on to the time 3 years ago when someone didn't invite you to a birthday party, or hold on to an imagined slight when a friend didn't call you back when they said that they would. And you hold on to that. You cling on to that past hurt, and you remain suffering with it. And the same thing about holding on to a future that hasn't yet happened and imagine it to be true. The other thing that we know, and this has been shown to be true in neuroscience, is that avoidance of suffering generally leads to more suffering. So that what happens is that you say, I don't want to think about that. I don't want to think about the suffering that happened. I don't want to pay attention to my sadness right now. And we try to squash it, and what we know is that it comes back like a vengeance. It's like holding a lid on a pot of boiling water. It comes back. It really builds up and then spills over and can burn us. The next idea is that in terms of controlling, learning to take control of your mind, is that you can choose where to focus your attention. So that people get stuck with the idea that, you know, they have to focus their attention on the past hurt, the past phone call that wasn't returned, or the time that someone said something not nice. But you can decide that what you're going to focus your attention on is the color of a flower, or the rise and fall of a breath, or the smell of something cooking on the stove, or a sunset, or whatever it is. That you can make that choice, that you don't have to get stuck focusing your attention on the past injury. And then you can choose what to do with what is, rather than with you imagine it to be. So the idea is that one thing is to say that I think that someone doesn't like me, versus saying, well, I don't know whether they like me or not, but I'm going to focus my attention on what I do know rather than what I am suffering with, and often what I have created in my mind to be true. Now, one of the things that I say to a lot of people, because people who know me know that I don't like to use medications as a solution for all the problems with borderline personality disorder. And so what happens is that I say, imagine that there was a drug that would reduce anxiety and panic. So and now this drug I showed you had scientific evidence of efficacy, that it was, you know, that there were placebo-controlled studies that showed the following. It could reduce anxiety and panic. It could reduce depression and rates of depression relapse. It could reduce binge eating. It could reduce numbing and avoidance and post-traumatic stress disorder. It could reduce chronic pain. It could reduce symptoms of fibromyalgia. It could reduce stress levels. It could reduce high blood pressure and high pulse rate. It could improve self-regulation. It could improve attention and concentration. It could improve interpersonal functioning and response to drug treatment. So here is a drug that could do every one of these things, and you could take it whenever you wanted to take it, and you didn't have to worry about it for insurance coverage. In fact, it would cost you nothing. And that there would be very few of any side effects. I mean, who wouldn't sign up for such a drug? And yet mindfulness has been shown in multiple studies to have these effects. And yet for many people, especially if they struggle with borderline personality disorder, but not only those people, also people, most of us, want an easier way out. And what we're suggesting is that here is the drug that we're talking about, and that drug is mindfulness. And so I just want to say one more thing before I turn it over to Dr. Galen, and that is that because people get somewhat skeptical about mindfulness, there is a lot of research that's now going on into the neuroimaging and neurobiology of mindfulness. And what quite a few studies have now shown is that this is not something that you have to be, you know, going over to Tibet, sitting in a cave for many, many years before you get it right. That in as few as 8 weeks of practice, you begin to see neurobiological changes in the brain that equate to the practice of mindfulness. And actually, what you see is that if you scan the brains of people who have been doing mindfulness for a long period of time, that they have a lot of activity in certain areas. And people who have just been doing it for 8 or so weeks begin to have activity in the same areas of the mind and the brain that the for instance, Buddhist monks and other monks have experienced. Now, the other thing is that, this is again pertinent to borderline personality disorder, is that the areas of the brain that show tremendous activity in terms of high emotional arousal, you know, the limbic system, when people practice mindfulness, those areas of the brain begin to quieten and down. So you can imagine, again, its utility in borderline personality disorder when people have tremendous emotional experiences. So the other aspect of this is that given that a lot of the lives of people with BPD have a lot of stress, what we know is that mindfulness also reduces the stress hormone cortisol. Now, this sounds absolutely wonderful. I mean, here we have this practice that is fantastic. It can reduce all these things. It could improve your life and da-da-da-da-da-da. And yet it is very difficult to do, as with anything else. It would be as if I were to say, you know, to all of our non-Japanese-speaking listeners, we're all going to go and learn Japanese. I mean, you know, that you can imagine that a lot of these practices are going to be difficult. So, yes, they have benefit. And yes, it is also quite difficult. So what I'm going to do at this point is I'm going to ask you to stop mindfully listening to me, and I'm going to ask you to mindfully listen to Dr. Galen.
So I'm going to pick up where Blaise left off and talk a little bit about the function of mindfulness. So Blaise had talked about sort of the habits that we have, and I think we all, I mean, most of our life is pretty habitual. I think we can all think about and driving is actually a wonderful way to look at habits, and most of us have probably driven on a highway and sort of, you know, you're paying attention, but you look up and you're about four exits past the last exit sign that you noticed. I mean, I think we do a lot of things sort of on automatic pilot. We drive to work every morning, and we really don't pay attention, that we're really not aware of habits. And I think when we have habits that cause a lot of problems in our lives, that's actually where we get stuck. And so what mindfulness is really doing is it's seeking awareness. So it's teaching people to bring awareness in a very specific way to their experience, to their relationships, to their thoughts, to their emotions, and to their behaviors. So it's actually the exact opposite of avoidance. So most of the time when we're teaching people mindfulness, they think that this is a really terrible idea, that why on earth would you want to bring your awareness and your attention to painful emotions, difficult relationships, failures, like what Blaise had talked about is that, you know, what we find is that actually when you don't bring your awareness to those things, you suffer and you end up pretty miserable. So mindfulness is actually not about changing your thoughts or your experience at all. So the goal of mindfulness is really to bring your attention, bring your awareness, and at the same time learn to step back. So be able to attend to an experience, step back and look at it, without getting sort of sucked up in it, which is a very, very, very challenging task for anyone, particularly for people with borderline personality disorder who experience emotions very intensely. So this is definitely a challenge. So I guess, you know, a lot of people ask why we teach mindfulness to people with BPD and their families. And, you know, there are two empirically validated treatments. So both DBT and mindfulness-based cognitive behavioral therapy actually use mindfulness as the central skill in their treatment. And both agree that when you're actually unaware of what goes on in your mind, you can be really dragged around by your emotions and your thoughts. So I often describe this to people as it's almost as if you're on the back of, sort of attached to the back of a boat, maybe tubing. And as the boat turns hard to the left, you swing way out to the right, and you don't have a whole lot of control over that. And so what mindfulness does is it says, well, if we teach you to bring your awareness, then you're not going to get thrown around so much, that you're actually going to be able to start to pay attention, to move your mind to the place that you want to go, to be able to step back and not get completely caught up in the emotions that you're experiencing. And what we also have found is that actually when you look closely at some at destructive, dangerous, and impulsive behaviors, they're often a result of being thrown around what's going on in your mind. So either being sort of completely caught up in an emotion where you aren't able to step back and see maybe consequences or impacts or even remember your goals at hand. So in BPD, this can be an incredibly powerful skill to learn. And what we also have found is that really lack of awareness can just in general have a negative impact on really important relationships in people's lives with their family, with their friends, and with important treatment providers. So Blaze loves Zen shorts, so I have decided that I would share a Zen short with you. So in the formal practice of mindfulness, with its roots in Buddhism, one of the ways that they make points and sort of teachings is through these short little stories called Zen shorts. So I'm going to tell you a very short one. So the story goes like this. So one day Buddha was speaking to a prince. The prince asked him, "What do you and your monks do in the monastery?" Buddha said, "We sit, and we walk, and we eat." The prince said, "Well, how are you and your monks different from me and my people? And we do all those things as well." The Buddha responded, "When we sit, we know we are sitting. When we walk, we know we are walking. When we eat, we know we are eating." So this just speaks to that point. So what we're teaching is complete awareness of what we're doing in the moment. So we all can eat mindfully, and most of us eat mindlessly. Most of us sit down and eat or drive, and maybe we're talking on the phone or we're reading a magazine. So the idea is that we can do everything that anyone else can do, but we're doing it with awareness so that we know what we're doing in that moment. So we practice DBT, so you know we use mindfulness as a skill in DBT. And so what I'm going to do is I'm just going to talk briefly about how we teach it, what the skills of mindfulness are. And Blaze and I have added a couple skills. But what I really want you to do is to think about how developing these skills could be useful in your lives. So I'm going to give a very, very short overview of these kinds of skills. And then next week we're going to actually come back to the skills. And we're going to teach you how to practice them. So different practices sort of in your daily life about, okay, this is what I could do for a couple minutes every day to develop this skill. So Marsha Linehan divides up mindfulness skills into what you're supposed to do, which is often confusing, and then how you're supposed to do it. So the first thing that we teach people to do is to just observe. So what we're asking people to do, and this is actually probably the hardest mindfulness skill, so we're asking you to just notice your experience. So notice thoughts, notice feelings, notice sensations, and notice them without actually labeling them or doing anything to them. So you notice with all of your senses, and this act sort of turns off the thinking part of your mind, which often gets very revved up with stress and anxiety. So observing is challenging because most of the things in our lives we can very quickly label, right? So we often would maybe hear a bell and then we would label it, that sound a bell. So what observing does is it just challenges you to just notice an experience. So think about noticing a sunrise or a sunset and just sort of watching as the colors change without maybe naming all of the colors, just watching the experience and noticing what happens. So that's the first sort of fundamental thing that you do. And observing is often not done alone in the practice. So you can do observing practices, but most people will move more into to a describe. So the second thing that you do is that you start to describe things when you're practicing mindfulness. But it's a very specific way of describing. So you're just putting words to an experience. It's not an opinion, but it's a fact. So it's almost like you think that you are a researcher making fact-based observations for an experiment. And it's often here where we find that judgments kind of come in. And we're going to talk a little bit about judgments. I'm going to talk a little bit about judgments in a minute or two. But judgments are not facts. So when we're practicing describing mindfully, we're doing so by labeling it with facts. So nobody can argue with how you're describing something. So you must observe first, so notice the experience, and then you describe. And so describing allows you to sort of categorize your experiences and communicate them to yourself and to others. So we can describe something like an emotion, in a very fact-based way, or we can describe it in a very judgmental way. Now, most people find that, especially with borderline personality disorder, that where they get caught up in this practice is that they end up not being able to describe things non-judgmentally. It's very, very hard, unless you're paying attention, to describe an emotion without a judgment. So imagine if you're feeling a lot of anxiety. So if you were to practice the describe mindfulness skill to your anxiety, you might say that you're noticing butterflies in your stomach. You're noticing that your cheeks are getting red. You're noticing that your heart is racing, that you're noticing that your breath is increasing. So describing really puts words to an experience without a judgment. I'll talk a little bit about how the judgment in doing that same task can get us in trouble. But so just to think about ways that you could use that describe skill in your life, maybe particularly around maybe an emotion or an experience, and to do so with just facts. So the next skill that I'm going to talk about, that Marcia talks about, is to participate. So right now, in learning to do mindfulness, what you do is you observe, then you might describe, and in another situation, you might participate. So the idea with participating is to participate without self-consciousness. So you're going to throw yourself into an experience fully, doing it in that moment, and really letting go of all sort of embarrassment or anxiety, and really being one with the experience. Now, when you're first learning, for some people, this is very, very fun. And for other people, I remember when I first learned this, this was absolutely terrifying. And maybe we'll teach you guys next week some more fun participate practices where you just really have to let go of self-consciousness. I think when one of the times in a training with Marcia, I think she had about 150 people do the hokey pokey. So if you imagine that, it's just really letting yourself fully participate so that you're not getting caught up in what do people think or, oh my gosh, I'm making a fool of myself, but you can actually participate fully in that moment. So those are the skills that we teach around what you do. So when people say, what do you do to practice mindfulness? You observe, you describe, and then you participate. So the next question is how you do it. So the first thing that you do that we've talked about before is that you do this with intention. So if I'm going to do something mindfully, I know that I'm going to do it. So I'm going to say, okay, tonight when I wash the dishes, I'm going to wash the dishes mindfully. So I know that I'm doing it, which is really important, because if you don't know that you're doing it, then that's not the practice. So the second thing that we talk about is to do it without judgment. And this is probably one of the most important mindfulness skills. And I talked a little bit about it, I alluded to it in when we talked about describing. But so for people that maybe may not be as clear, and I know I think when I first started to think about judgments, I had to really kind of learn about the definitions because I think we use them so freely. But judgments are basically shorthand. So they're a shorthand assessment of an experience, right? And so because they're a shorthand, they leave out information. And there are times when judgments are very, very important because you don't want to, you know, somebody asks you a question and you may want to say, they say, how was your lunch? And you might say, well, my lunch was good. But good is a judgment. What might be good for me, a lunch that was good for me may not be a lunch that was good for Blaze or for you. Very common judgments are good, bad, stupid, ugly, pretty. Judgments around what should be or what shouldn't be. So these are all shorthands that we use. The problem with judgments is that they really prevent curiosity. So once I say my lunch was good, that's sort of the end of the conversation. So judgments tend to stop curiosity. They're often quite habitual. And the problem with them is that they can really enhance negative emotions. So things like sadness, anger, guilt, and shame can be really increased. The intensity of that emotion can be increased with judgments. And if you ask probably anyone, when they're feeling those feelings already, the last thing that they're looking for is to increase the intensity. The problem is that we often do that unmindfully, so we don't actually even know we're doing it. So you can think back to the anxiety example that I had talked about around describing. So I had described my anxiety with facts, right? I talked about how I felt it in my body. I could do it with judgments, right? And so anybody that's had a lot of anxiety has probably gotten caught in this pattern before, in which they say, I'm feeling anxiety, I can't stand this anxiety, anxiety is bad, this is the worst thing, anxiety I've ever had, I don't know what to do, this is terrible, I hate this, I can't stand this. So what you'll notice is my anxiety is going to get worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. So for the people that, for people with borderline personality disorder, for family members, and then for everyone else, to be able to pay attention and to describe your emotional experience by sticking with the facts can actually relieve a lot of suffering because it gives you an opportunity to stay with the emotion without enhancing it. Because what we know is when you do things to enhance emotions or suppress emotions, which judgments can do both of, it only increases the intensity. So we spend a lot of time literally paying attention to judgments. We actually will have kids on our unit use clickers, so the little people counter clickers, and we'll ask them to spend 24 or 48 hours and actually click every time they notice a judgmental thought. And we've had some incredible numbers in the up to, I think, 700. But what one thing that we do know is that when you actually bring your awareness to a behavior, or in this case a thought, it starts to decrease the intensity because you start to begin to catch yourself. So it's a pretty powerful experience if anybody is curious about how to start with judgments, but really to pay attention to, maybe even if you just do a couple hours, to pay attention, write it down, do tick marks, and just start to bring your awareness to how many judgments you make. Now, the one pitfall here is that you have to make sure to not judge your judging, which is often where we get stuck. So we think, okay, here we go, or, you know, Jillian gave me this practice, I'm going along and I'm clicking, and oh my God, I hate my judgments, I have so many judgments. And then we start judging our judging. So the key is to actually just observe and describe our judgments. So the next thing that we talk about, and I think Blaise had talked about this a little bit in the beginning, is doing things one mindfully. So focus on doing one thing in the moment. So driving without your radio and without your cell phone. So actually doing one thing in the moment is fundamental to the practice of mindfulness, and it's deceivingly simple. So we feel like, oh, yeah, we can do that, no problem. But then when it comes down to it, I think many of us are multitaskers, and we actually have to stop and pay attention and realize that we're multitasking, step back, and decide to do one thing in the moment, which is actually very, very hard. But what most people will find is that when you do one thing at a time, you're actually much more efficient. So it's sort of, we get fooled into this idea that multitasking, we're actually getting more done. But for the majority of the population, when we do one thing at a time, we get it done more effectively and more efficiently. So then the next thing we do is we talk about doing things effectively. So this skill is a very interesting one, and it's a challenge for everyone. It's often a challenge, I think, for adolescents in general. But when you practice effectiveness with mindfulness, you're doing what the situation calls for. And this can sound easy, but where most people get stuck is that when you insist on being right. So I think most people can think about how this has shown up in their life, but the idea with effectively is to pay attention to not getting stuck in being right over being effective. So there may be situations, I think most people can think of them, of times where you actually knew you were right. You knew that, you know, your decision was right. But actually, what was most effective in the situation was letting go of what was right and doing what the overall situation called for. And so what this does is it helps people build awareness so that you don't make the situation worse. And I think this can be tremendously powerful, to actually be able to step back and realize that, wait a minute, I'm getting caught. I need to look at what is going to be most effective for the situation so that I don't make my situation worse. Because often what you find is that when we get caught up in our emotions, we make the situation worse very, 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 very quickly. And then the last thing that that we talk about and find pretty important is to do things non-reactively, right? So it can be very, very, very difficult for people with borderline personality disorder to not react quickly. So what we're asking is, again, to go back to that observe skill and to step back before reacting. So to be open, to be curious, to be accepting, and to just patiently allow the experience to happen without reacting, or at least without reacting immediately. So those are the basic skills that I went through very, very quickly. It's a lot to pay attention to. And next week we're going to spend some time actually breaking them down and looking at what could you actually do in your life that would practice. How do you get better at doing one thing in the moment? How do you get better at and more skilled at fully participating or describing or being non-judgmental? So we're going to, hopefully you can look forward to that for next week. And just a final word on kind of the practice in general. And I think that most people can practice mindfulness. There are some, in some cases around psychosis, that it's not actually very useful. But the majority of people can practice mindfulness. It doesn't matter how old you are or if you kind of know about it or don't, but that it's something that everybody can learn. And I like to think about mindfulness as a muscle in your brain. So it's similar to what Blaise had talked about. It's one of those things where if you practice, you build the muscle. And when you stop practicing, it sort of atrophies and you lose it. And then you have to go back. The nice thing that I always tell people is that once you have started to practice mindfulness, you can always go back to it. So let's see. And the last couple things is that often I think if you talk to mindfulness practitioners, and this certainly happens with me, is that you sort of get into a catch-22. And the fact that when you need mindfulness the most, you tend to not have time, be too busy, be too tired. So mindfulness practice is a real commitment, I think, for everyone. I think even for the most advanced practitioners. And, you know, finally, I think, like pretty much any skill that you're going to learn, the idea with mindfulness is that you need to practice mindfulness when you don't need it as much so that you can find it when you do. So practicing when you're not in distress, practicing just day to day so that when you actually are in distress, you get some of the payoff for your practice. So that is what we have prepared for you guys tonight, and I think we now have a little bit of time for any questions that people have.
Okay, thank you, both of you. Thank you so much. I have a question, actually, that was posed to me yesterday where I presented it. It was all psychiatrists. But the question was, when someone has ADD, how does that interfere with them practicing mindfulness? And what sort of kinds of tips do you give, especially for people struggling with that?
So can you hear me? You can
hear me? Yes.
Yeah, okay, good. I think that obviously it's very difficult to pay attention when the attentional circuits in your brain don't seem to work that well. There's an irony to ADD in that a lot of parents who have children and adults with ADD say that they seem to be able to pay attention to, for instance, video games or to something they're interested in. And the fact of the matter is that even kids with ADD and adults with ADD are able to pay attention. It's often that their capacity to focus when there's something very interesting is there. But it seems that they're also very easily distracted. But the circuits are there, and they need to be built. And so, yes, those circuits are weaker than those who don't have ADD, but like Gillian gave the analogy of it being a muscle, and so maybe it's a weak muscle, and so a lot of exercise needs to go in order to strengthen it. But I don't know if, and there's actually one study that has shown that augmenting stimulant medication with mindfulness leads to a marked increase in overall focus and attention in people who do both over just medication?
Yeah, I actually I'm actually very interested in this. I've worked with a fair number of kids actually with ADHD around mindfulness, and what's actually interesting is that some of the most a big area of actually study in yoga research around using mindfulness through the modality of yoga, they've gotten some of the best results actually in adolescent boys with ADHD, which is, it's sort of like an amazing thing. I remember reading it and thinking, you know, this makes no sense, and then, you know, having some experience with those boys and also with some kids in my office is that, I mean, I think the modality of yoga helps with it because there's movement. But I think really you just have to know sort of the right practices to get people with that struggle more with attention kind of hooked on it. And then they seem to do just as well as everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Also, someone had asked me, does Tai Chi help with mindfulness?
Sorry, can you repeat the question? Sorry.
Does Tai Chi help with mindfulness?
You know, I think, you know, one of the things about Tai Chi and any practice is that Tai Chi tends to be one of those very precise things where there's very precise a series of movements, like with almost anything. And I think that the idea of any formal practice of anything where you have to pay attention, if you do pay attention and you bring your attention mm-hmm. to that practice, can help with mindfulness. Mm-hmm. Often what Westerners do with Eastern practices is to remove the mindfulness aspect of the practice, but I think that in traditional Tai Chi, mindfulness was accentuated. Again, for many of these practices, I don't know that there's formal Western studies to say that Tai Chi in and of itself does. But if you were to take your attention, does mindful cooking help with mindfulness? Yes, it does. Does mindful Tai Chi help with mindfulness? Yes, it does. And I think that anything where you do have to follow a certain sequence, like a dance, like a formal dance, that can help with mindfulness.
Yeah, as you were saying that, I was also thinking of, you know, the kids who were in different activities, you know, what those activities are and that they focus specifically on that, but that probably trains their mind to be able to do that in other areas as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and it's also, I think, with any, you see that with athletes.
Yeah.
As well, sort of, it's as long as it's done with attention, you know, and
yeah.
most of them will tell you, you know, I have to, you know, I'm a swimmer and I'm on the starting block. I cannot get distracted by the fact that I, you know, broke up with my boyfriend or, you know, whatever happened, that I actually have to tune my mind and focus it in that moment. And that's mindfulness. I mean, anything where you're practicing putting your mind on one, you know, one place and that you're doing it and that when you get distracted, you bring your mind back is going to build that muscle.
Right, right. Well, there are emails coming in saying, thank you, excellent call, and one has a question as well on it. Any thoughts for how to help or teach my daughter that is resistant to doing anything with DBT, and she knows mindfulness is a part of DBT? How can I sort of try to convince her to try it in spite of her feelings about DBT?
Look, I have adolescent children who don't have BPD, and trying to get them to do anything that I want them to do is difficult, period. Part of this is normal being a parent, trying to convince a child the benefit of exercise or eating well or not having too much ice cream and all of this. And I think that what my perspective is on this is that there are some people who are very receptive to the idea of mindfulness, and there are others who absolutely aren't. And that often, if you do it yourself and show the efficacy of it, so if you're a very stressed out parent who all of a sudden begins to show a lot more calm, a lot more compassion, a lot more curiosity, a lot more peacefulness in a way, that they tend to become more curious about what it is that they've done. So if you open it to saying, you know, you know, maybe this is something that can help you. Certainly trying to say, look, we're going to force this on you would generally not work. As with anything else, you have to want to do it. But, you know, often, you know, even with very little children, I've taught my, you know, 8-year-old to practice the idea of one thing in the moment. And, you know, so maybe hopefully that would be a lesson that would stick as he ages. But it is difficult. It's difficult for people without BPD to practice mindfulness, let alone people with BPD. But I think that certainly showing them through example is one way to do it. And also the other way is if they are willing to attend a group where mindfulness is practiced, often other people will begin to talk about the utility in their lives.
Do you have any information, because I think there's more research coming out that ADHD maybe, you know, in part people with BPD maybe have a higher percent. I don't know. Have you heard data on that?
There is some very interesting data on that one of the paths of the formation of borderline personality disorder could be through ADD, especially in women. And so the idea is this. If you have a young woman who is has got ADD and whose attentional circuits aren't working all that well. And so what happens is that a parent says, hey, I want you to do this. And if they're paying attention, they do it. But if they're not paying attention, they don't do it. For the parent who's not aware that the child has ADD, because they're not hyperactive, they're not so much ADHD, you know, they can get upset with the child, you're not paying attention, you're not listening to me, and so that the child themselves gets variable responses. So sometimes the parent's yelling at them, sometimes they're not, and they're confused, why are they yelling at me now, why are they not yelling at me, and all of those sorts of things. And so that the idea is that over time, that those kind of variable responses get integrated into the child's sense of self, and then they feel misunderstood, they feel that they feel they can become more agitated. So there is some research that ADD is a precursor to vulnerability factor to borderline personality disorder, especially in young women. And there's some research that's out of Australia, and I'm sure that some of the circuits will eventually be found to be similar.
Okay. Some people are more attuned to visual learning and others learn better through hearing. Do you ever need to address these differences when offering mindfulness as a skill?
You know, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, we would want to, you know, we generally, I mean, I think teach mindfulness. We teach it a couple different ways. So we teach it literally didactically. So we teach them, you know, in a classroom, and we have lots of handouts. But then we also do a lot of experiential teaching in mindfulness, and actually find that, you know, understanding the concepts is one thing, and you can do that through really any way. You can do it visually, you can do it through auditory channels, but that actually the most effective way is actually through practice. And we have all different, I mean, we have, you know, hundreds of different kinds of practices. And so the people, you know, when we're teaching it, people tend to kind of gravitate towards, when they're in the learning phase, they kind of gravitate towards, you know, whichever makes the most sense. But, you know, in general, we teach it in so many different ways, and it's such an experiential practice that it actually hasn't mattered very much, kind of, you know, which sort of different ways of preferred learning, because you really cover most of them.
Right, and then I think that ultimately, as Julian said, is that, you know, pay attention. So if someone is a very visual learner, that they might gravitate towards a visual focus in terms of their mindful practice, you know, as a way of getting there, because and others might do it through another sense, a tactile sense or whatever it is. But ultimately, you know, and the focus circuits might be slightly different. There's also some very nice new research on focusing on things that are going on inside of you. So, for instance, focusing on your breath uses more primitive brain circuits than focusing, for instance, on a sunset, which is something external to you. And so you can also get to practice different things, you know, internal to you and external to you. And but people have to find what works for them. And for some people, just focusing on their breath is very intolerable, whereas focusing on sensations might be easier.
I think also that I've often found, and I know actually within sort of my own way of learning, that actually the act of mindfulness, you can sort of, if you are weaker in one area, you know, as opposed to the other, you can actually build some strength in that other, sort of in your, you can kind of look at where you're weaker, you know, maybe visually, and you can actually use mindfulness to help you sort of build sort of visual attention circuits. Mm-hmm. So I know I've worked with a lot of people that have been actually very surprised where they've had, you know, long patterns of learning histories where they've had a very, very difficult time, say, as an auditory learner. And so they've had a long history of having very, you know, very difficult time, for example, being in classes or in meetings and taking in information, and have actually found that as they've practiced mindfulness, while that may not be their strongest way of learning, that they've actually noticed significant improvements. So, I mean, I think that's been pretty interesting. It's been my experience as well, because you're learning that what you need is you need to learn to attend more in an area that you may be weaker in.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to go back to your clicker. In addition to a clicker, what other techniques can be used to reinforce the practice?
A clicker is just one way that I've used to bring awareness to sort of any behavior that you want to track. A clicker is nice because it sort of, you have to do something. I know people who have a pad of paper and they make tick marks.
Mm-hmm.
They have a journal that mm-hmm. they, you know, they write the one sentence in for whatever they're tracking.
Well, the other thing is, if you're talking about the practices of noticing judgments, then certainly what Julian says is absolutely right. They can do it on their diary card as well. But if you're talking about the question of the practice of mindfulness per se, one of the things, and we'll get a little bit into this more next week, is the idea of literally setting aside some time. So and doing it that way. If you say, how do you get more into the practice? Well, it's like, how do you get more into the practice of exercising every day? You know, we eat every day, and we, you know, so we have a practice of habitual, you know, breakfast, lunch, and supper, or we go to the gym every day. You know, so the idea of saying, okay, you know, from 1 to 1:15 every day, I'm going to sit still and breathe, or whatever it is, so that it's building it into your life. And we'll talk a little bit more about that next week. So I just wasn't clear if it was the practice of mindfulness or the practice of noticing judgment.
Yeah, I think it's noticing judgment. Two last questions. One is, where can people get some training? Any recommendations?
I know that the mindfulness-based stress reduction MBSR mm-hmm. offers certification in MBSR, and I know certainly in our town there's a lot of people who go and do those certifications. But there's because mindfulness practice is becoming more universally accepted. I know, for example, as well that there are Zen centers around many towns where people can go and do formal or informal practices. But I think that certainly doing it with someone who is trained, doing it with someone who, with a group of people who are similarly going through those practices is the way to go. Because as with anything, if you wanted to learn French or whatever it is, it's good to have a coach and a teacher, but we find a lot of stuff online in terms of mindfulness training. I know that a lot of colleges and universities are now offering courses either for credit or just as in terms of wellness within their wellness programs. We're beginning to introduce it into our local schools. So I think, you know, going online, different towns have a different focus on it, but go, you know, maybe going online and in your particular area, just seeing if there are you know, Zen centers. And the other thing is if you're a very spiritual person through your own practice, you know, if you're a Christian, you might want to do Christian contemplative prayer. In some, if you're, you know, Muslim, you might want to look into Sufi Islam and look at mystical practices, but you can do it through spirituality as well.
I think, most, you can also, most yoga studios often have a, like a seated meditation, maybe that's an open, free meditation. I know most yoga studios have them. It seems to be now that most continuing education programs in towns or counties are actually offering a lot of, like, adult education. You'll find some sort of basic introduction to mindfulness classes. And then certainly, I mean, MBSR is all over the place, but that's a very formal, and that's a very formal teaching. But I think, you know, depending on the area that you're in, you may be surprised it's out there, kind of more than you think.
Okay. And one last question. Is there any mini homework assignment or something that we should all think about for next week?
Okay, so maybe we can each give you one. So here is what I would like the participants to do. I'd like you to do one of three things. I'd like you to mindfully pay attention to something that you do habitually. So if you brush your teeth with your right hand, I want you to switch and brush your teeth with your left hand for a week. So just, if you do it three times a day, just do your evening one with your other hand. If you normally drive one specific way to work, if you could find a different way to do it and pay attention to the new neighborhood, pay attention to the sights and sounds, and do so without having the radio on or without having your cell phone. Actually, put your cell phone in the trunk until you get to work. And then the third thing is I'd like you to think about a relationship that you have and do something very unexpected. So if what you ordinarily do is, buy flowers for someone on a Wednesday evening, I'd like you to do something like maybe buy it on a Tuesday and a Thursday. So think about something that is very, very habitual in your life in terms of relationship and do something for someone that is somewhat unexpected, but you're doing with attention. And then I'd be curious if people could bring back, what they discovered. And Jillian may have some other little homework assignments.
Or maybe people can actually send it in ahead of time so we could have some homework review if people would like. Go ahead, Jillian.
Do you have
some? Sure. You took some of the big basic ones.
Okay.
I think I'll maybe do one of my favorite ones. So the assignment is before next week, what I would like people to do is for 2 minutes, so this is going to involve sort of carving out 2 minutes of time, sitting somewhere quietly. So the best thing to do is to set like a kitchen timer or something so that you're not looking at the clock. And what I would like you to do is to observe an itch in your body. And what I'm going to ask you to do is I want you to observe the itch and not itch it. So for 2 minutes, just notice. I want you to pay attention to the intensity, to what it feels like in your body, to the urges, to whether it changes, stays the same, but not to itch it until the end of 2 minutes. And I'll be curious to know what people's experience is.
Okay, terrific. All right, well, thank you so much, and we look forward to next week to the second part of this. I think people, just by the emails that are coming in, are finding this very, very exciting and a new opportunity to learn how to do things differently from a different perspective.
Great.
So thank you, and we'll be all back together next week. We appreciate those of you who send in donations. It's the way we can keep these services going, so if you haven't done that yet, please think to do so. We'd greatly appreciate it. Okay, thank you.
Thank
you, Blaise and Jillian. Have a nice week.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.